Hello, and welcome to this MomsFightingAutism.com webinar. This is Chantal Cecile Kira, your moderator, and I am happy to announce that my guest this evening is Dr. Esther Hess, and our topic is Autism and the Holidays, Lessening the Stress and the Expectations While Maximizing the Enjoyment. Dr. Esther Hess is a developmental pediatric psychologist working in the areas of child, adolescent, and family therapy and developmental delays. She's an expert in her field, and she has over 30 years of experience. Welcome, Dr. Hess. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Chantal. How are you?
Good. You have a very impressive resume or curriculum vitae, and I wanted to hear a little bit more about your background. You have over 30 years of experience. You have quite a bit of academic experience as well. I understand that you studied under Dr. Greenspan.
Yes, Dr. Stanley Greenspan is my mentor and has been. I've actually been his senior clinician on the West Coast for about 30 years now. And I actually was introduced by Dr. Greenspan through my father, Dr. Leon Citrin, who himself is a child psychiatrist in the Washington, D.C. area. Mm-hmm. And how I got associated with Dr. Greenspan is there was a period of time when, way back when, my dad, who is considered the, I guess at this point, the grandfather of childhood depression, said, you know, when I was trying to decide what area of expertise I was going to go into formally after I got my PhD, he said, you're very good with kids. And he said, I foresee the next kind of main onslaught of childhood issues being autism. This is before it sort of hit the papers. And he says, I have a wonderful gentleman who at one point in his early career was one of my students, Stan Greenspan. And he's somebody to really listen and follow. So if you can take the time to go back to Washington, D.C. and follow him, it's worth your while. So my dad has always been, I guess, my original mentor. And I followed his advice and met with Stan and his partner, Dr. Serena Weider, and they became both friends, colleagues, and certainly mentors. And I became an expert in the field using a method of intervention for kids with developmental and regulatory disorders called DIR, floor time.
And for those listeners who are not familiar with that, would you like to explain a little bit about that?
Sure. Floor time is a developmental relational approach that asks you to think about three things when you're dealing with a child. First off, most of the kids that we are working with, or young adults even at this point, they are often younger than their chronological age. So that you join a child or an adult or an adolescent, not where they are necessarily chronologically, but where they are at that moment developmentally. So that's D for DIR. Then you have to ask yourself, okay, well, what is the I, the individual neurological difference that could possibly be fueling some of the complex issues that are making the development not at its optimum level? And so then it's our sensitivity to be aware of things such as sensory processing issues, for example. And then through our R, through our relationship, we have to support those individual differences and thereby helping the child or the adolescent or the young adult move forward in terms of moving to the best place that they can be developmentally. So that's DIR, and once you figure out where a child or a young person is, then what you could do is you can start the involvement, the play, and that's floor time.
Great. And you also have a lot of experience in other areas, not just with autism or developmental delay. You have experience with divorce issues, with lots of different areas, and in fact, center that you've you're now the director of is the Center for the Developing Mind, isn't that correct?
Right, exactly. About a year and a half ago, I have been, so to speak, the Center for the Developing Mind for the more than 30 years that I've been here in the Los Angeles, California area. And my family's continuously said to me, Dr. Hess, can't you help create a one-stop wellness? Because we are constantly schlepping from interventionist to interventionist to interventionist all over the city. And not everybody talks to each other, or they take days to get back and forth. Can't we have one cohesive place where our kids can get help? And so we listened. And with my husband and business partner, Alan Sampson, I created Center for the Developing Mind, which is just that one-stop wellness, that cohesive treatment facility. So it's a multidisciplinary treatment facility for kids with developmental delays, as you had suggested, but also kids with regulatory issues and other concerns. So we treat kids with attention deficit, with bipolar disorder, a variety of different learning issues, trauma. We have a specialty for children who are burn survivors. We have kids who come in because they have concerns associated with, as I mentioned, parental divorce. Or I also have a secondary specialty that happened about 15 years ago called selective mutism, which is an extreme form of social anxiety, social phobia. And we treat all those through myself as a mental health interventionist. We also have occupational therapists, physical therapists, speech and language educational support. We have a homeschooling option, vision therapists, neuropsychologists, feeding specialists, a geneticist on board now. Basically, you name it, and we have what it takes to make both the child and the family feel that they're getting as much and the max amount of support possible.
And that brings us to an important point in the fact that autism is autism, but it's not just a concern for the child. It affects the whole family. So your practice is really looking at the whole child. And I know that you don't deal just with autism, but the fact that you do deal with divorce and all these other issues, as well as children who have other types of challenges that they're facing, makes a lot of sense because there's a lot going on in autism families.
Right, of course. Well, I mean, you know, our center, we treat from birth to the age of 22, but as you very aptly suggest, I have never yet met a child who lives alone. So, right. You know, to myself, it just didn't make sense not to deal with the family as a whole. And certainly when you have a child who has as profound a disorder as autism, it absolutely impacts everybody in the family. And I just felt, and after working so many years with, you know, children and their families, that we had to create a cohesive package.
Right. And which kind of leads us to our topic today about autism and the holidays, of lessening the expectations while maximizing the enjoyment. Because just talking about holidays in general without even thinking about having a child with special needs or with autism, holidays are stressful because of all the inherent expectations that people have about getting together, about the gift giving, and all these other things. Did you want to talk a little bit about the stress of holidays, not even thinking about the autism aspect?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, first off, you know, whether it's you're following the media or you have your own kind of homespun memories or ideas or wishes, I think we all have expectations that often are not very realistic in terms of what the holiday is supposed to present. And then you get together with family, and oftentimes all these expectations, which are often unrealistic, kind of come crashing together. And people feel at worst disappointed, and at best sometimes they just feel, you know, that they can't believe that the experience happened and they don't know kind of what went wrong. And it just can really start off, can make the end of the year terrible and start off the beginning of the new year in not the best of ways. So I like to really help my families prepare appropriately. I mean, I start talking about holiday time really around the time of Halloween, because for a lot of our families, starting about Halloween all the way through the beginning of the new year can be a very stressful time.
Right. I actually was speaking with friends earlier this week and saying that there should be a way to change things so that Thanksgiving, which is actually my most favorite holiday, happens like 3 months before Christmas,
right,
so that you have time to, like, recuperate.
Right.
Into, because then you could actually enjoy all the things that you should be doing or need to be doing before Hanukkah or Christmas or whatever.
Chantal, I think you can enjoy it. I think really, though, what it takes is a different kind of planning. And this is what I go ahead and I share with my families. You know, regardless in terms of why children are having, you know, the issues, I try to get families to understand what and why a child is struggling, and then how we can sort of circumvent that by us thinking ahead and planning differently. And then even the fact that there's only about a month between Thanksgiving and Christmas, I think we can really plan for some really wonderful times together.
Great. So that's why I'm glad you're here, because we have plenty of questions.
Okay.
I'm going to start asking you some of them, if that's okay. But before
Please.
I do that,
mm-hmm.
I would like to ask you, do you have a website that people could go to for more information about your practice
Absolutely.
And also find
yes.
out more information about yourself and also speaking engagements that you may have?
Absolutely. You're welcome to go onto my website for our Center for the Developing Mind, and that is www.centerfortheDevelopingMind.com. Again, www.centerforthedevelopingmind.com. And you can see the upcoming presentations. We've just actually returned from Utah and Colorado. And in the first part of January, we're actually going to the state of Florida. And then actually before the end of that month, we're actually going to be going also to three cities in North Carolina.
I noticed, too, you're going to be in San Diego.
I will be in San Diego, as a matter of fact. I will be in San Diego through the University of San Diego's Extension Program both in November of 2010 and January of 2011.
Oh, okay. So that's a little bit ways down the
way. It is. It is. We were actually in San Diego just this past September, and I'll be talking about DIR floor time and as it impacts sensory processing disorder.
Right, and that's a big part of the holidays, and we're going to talk about that as we go along. I can tell from many of the questions that we have.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to get started right now with a question from Carrie in Saginaw. What can I do to help my son, who is a 9-year-old Asperger's child, deal with the break from school? Because this is a less structured time, we seem to have a lot of outbursts and screaming that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
I also have three younger children, twins who are 6 and 5, who do not like to have the downtime,
mm-hmm.
the downtime to do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, they do like to have the downtime. So here this mother has the concern because she has three younger children, including twins, who like the downtime, and then you have a 9-year-old Asperger's child who does not deal well with the break from school. Any suggestions to this poor mother?
Absolutely. Well, first off, I have to give a lot of validation and empathy that you are experiencing a very real problem. Because what
yes.
fuels your three younger children absolutely is sort of the antithesis for what makes your 9-year-old comfortable. And the problem oftentimes in families where you have both typical and atypical developing kids is a lot of times the world does go around the child who is not typically developing. So what I like to do is, first off, keep in mind this sort of philosophy of DIR. In other words, and particularly, you know, even though the child, your 9-year-old son is chronologically 9, because of his Asperger's, he's probably developmentally somewhat younger. So I say to myself, okay, so what is that I? What is causing him to have that the problems? And they could be a multitude of issues in terms of sensory processing, delay, auditory, respiratory issues, visual spatial distortions, which we can talk about. But really what I think to myself is transitions are really, really tough. And what you state in your question is that the break from school is hard because the rhythm and the structure, which are so important for our kids who are on the spectrum, is missing. Consequently, their anxiety goes up a lot. So one of the things that I like to do is first of all try to understand what's going on, and then how do we go ahead and create both a structure for your son so he can feel better, but at the same time still acknowledge that there are three other sibs who have different needs. So one of the things what I would like to suggest is to go ahead and create a calendar, a very concrete calendar with all of your children, actually, but particularly the child who is the 9-year-old with Asperger's, about what to do during the holiday time and how we're going to break down the hours. However, in those hours, we're also going to have special time where we can have free time that can be included where the younger children can do what they want to do as well. Now, if that particular time is too difficult for the 9-year-old to join, I don't know, again, what the resources are in this family's home, whether there is a sitter or an aide, to go ahead and lend support, whether he needs to be home with a sitter, or could he come with somebody who could give him physical support while mom gives attention to the other three. But what I find, if you create a map, in particular a visual map, that gives a lot of support to our kids on the spectrum. And then I even like to add another piece that's sort of the kinetic portion that sort of validates and gives proprioceptive input, which actually helps reduce anxiety. I have a place where the chalk sort of click off, you know, like sign off, check off, or erase. What is the item that we've just accomplished? So let's say we have a program that we run from, say, 7 in the morning till 5 in the evening, which includes the activities that we're going to do. And the only thing it doesn't lend itself to be is some spontaneity, although you can sort of build it in, like from, you know, 3 to 4:30 one day, we're just going to have free time that can be decided by brother and sister, and during that time, you can do X, Y, or Z. And once a child sort of has a physical representation of what the schedule is going to be, they usually come, because as I said, anxiety is reduced by having that sort of concretized, predictable kind of element to their lives. And they're pretty good about following their routine and tolerating, even when they are doing things that they might otherwise appreciate, like, you know, giving credence to younger brothers and sisters' free time activities.
Right. And do you suggest in there, because I've always found, especially when you have numerous kids, that sometimes things happen that you can't control, you know, like the schedule changes?
Sure, sure.
I think it's a good idea when you have schedules to always, I always suggest to parents or teachers at school to, on the bottom of every schedule or planning is the comment, sometimes the schedule has to change or sometimes the schedule changes, because you never know if something happens.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, Chantal, I would even add to that. If the parent can even take one extra step, what I like to do, and for many of our families, I like to have them construct a social story, you know, with their child before holiday starts. Like, you know, something doesn't have to be very long, 4 to 5, 6 pages maximum. Basically, you know, the title can be, you know, we're about to take a break for Christmas, you know, something like that. And, you know, school is going to end, and you can have a little calendar on December 14th. And then I'm going to have 2 weeks off, and you can have another picture with the, you know, calendar. And again, somewhat, Mom and I are going to make a schedule. And then inclusive, exactly what you said. And sometimes, even when we make schedules, things change. And here's the most important phrase, and that's okay. This is sort of based off of the work of Carol Gray, who came up with this idea of social stories. And again, when she found that kids could participate in the creation of their stories, and with the understanding that things, life does change, if they could see it already and kind of anticipate it and have something concrete to hold in their hands and to visually take in, they were able to sort of calm their bodies and relax and feel things are a little bit more predictable, because even change was something that somebody had talked about ahead of time.
Right. That's right. It's really all about them getting used to the idea or preparing themselves mentally and emotionally for what's going to happen next.
Exactly, exactly, which is somewhat what you were talking about, how, you know, basically from Halloween on, we've got a lot of changes going on for us as well. And one of the things, aside from you don't have to be on the spectrum, kids take their cues off Mom and Dad. And Mom and Dad are feeling too stressed because, you know, there's a lot of money that goes out for the holidays, or parents feel that they have to have enormous kinds of expectations in terms of the kinds of foods they have to prepare, their house has to look a certain way, and they are stressed and can't sort of keep it together. Children pick up that underlying unconscious cue, and they kind of get as riled as the parents. So one of the things I talk about also is, you know, parent self-care and kind of lowering your own expectations for making whatever that means a perfect holiday.
Right. Good point. Okay, here's another question from Sandy in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
I have a young adult that stresses majorly over the holidays with questions like, who is coming? How long will they stay? What are we going to do? Then what? Other than medication, what can I say, as I don't have specific answers to all of her questions?
Okay. Well, first off, I want to acknowledge the fact that, you know, when it comes to young adults, you know, we have been working, you know, for multiple years on helping children, young children with autism. And then people have discovered, well, you know what, all these young kiddos that we've been helping all these years, they still need support. And so now there is a larger push to go ahead and get individuals involved to help with the transition issues that young adults have to deal with. And as a matter of fact, Bo, I was asked to be on a task force by our governor for autism and related disabilities. My specific specialty is early identification, early intervention. My husband, Alan Sampson, who I mentioned is also my business partner with our center, is actually a specialist in adults with developmental delays. And he's on the same task force but deals with these transitions, particularly for adults who have moderate to severe forms of autism, and helping them find the next stage of their journey in terms of both getting help and finding appropriate transitions to creating an optimum world in adult development. Getting back, though, to the actual question, what I see here again is that this young adult is stressed over the holiday again because things are different. And so consequently, their anxiety is up. And so I'll go back to my DIR format. D, even though this young man, I assume the question is that this is a young adult, meaning that he's acting more childlike, because when anybody has an anxiety, they all tend to regress. So I have to sort of respond to this person, not like maybe a young adult of, say, 22 or 25, but maybe kind of a younger person who might be more like, 14, 15, 16, and give a lot of support for that anxiety. So again, what I'm doing, and I appreciate the fact that this parent doesn't want to necessarily go through the medication route. Again, what I like to do is create a more sophisticated social story about the fact that things change over the holidays. And when things change, I have a lot of questions about what's going to happen. And sometimes I don't have all the answers, or mom doesn't have all the answers. And again, the buzzword is, and it is okay. But what we try to do is say, well, let's figure out as many questions as we can. We write them down together. And in other words, so we'll go ahead and we'll say, well, who's coming, who's going to be coming over, and put that answer, and how long are they going to stay, and so forth. And then that's concrete. So and we'll put that up maybe as a visual map someplace comfortable in the individual's room, or perhaps in the kitchen. And then when the person begins to perseverate a little bit, because oftentimes obsessive compulsive issues are often go hand in hand with autism, and this again is a reflection of just anxiety, we can go back and say, you know what, I think we have some of the answers. Let's see if we can find them. It takes a lot of extra patience on the part of the parent, because again, you have to have a lot of compassion for the fact that really what's talking is not incessant questions, but it's a reflection of the underlying anxiety. And then when the person sort of does see the answer, usually, again, because they have that visual tracking, they can begin to sort of calm and organize once they see it in written form.
Right. And it's something they can refer back to as well.
As often as they need to, exactly. And, in fact, that's what I often do. And I say, well, let's go back to, oh, look, you know what, that's exactly question two that we answered before. And so, again, and I reference, this is something that you can look at any time you need to in case that question comes up again.
Right. Good point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, another question from Bonnie Sedan in Brigham City, Utah.
Mm-hmm.
How do you minimize the 30 days of harassment? Can I have a present early? That's the kind of question this child, I don't know how old this child or teen is.
Mm-hmm.
We don't put under the tree because he cannot leave them alone. We don't keep presents in the house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Suggestions you have for minimizing the 30 days of harassment?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again, these are all reflections of very similar questions. Kids get very anxious when there's change. And everybody, whether or not you don't want to, I have families who, they used to say they used to put their Christmas trees up right after Thanksgiving, and now they may put it up 2 days before Christmas because it was just too hard for having all that stimulation in the house. But
this person's focusing on the presents, actually.
No, I understand. But you see, the point is, though, I'm not sure. The child, however old this child is, they're making the association with the present. I don't know, for instance, if there's a visual stimulus like a tree already put up. And so one of the things I would suggest is perhaps to wait, as long as you feel comfortable doing so, not to put up the tree, because that might be the cue for the child. Oh, tree means presents. And then what I would do, again, is, a lot of our kids get great comfort out of that visual map I'm talking about. So come up with a big, you can go to Staples or any kind of office or party store and come up with these, you know, big wall calendars. And go back to, you know, here's 30 days. Here's from Thanksgiving to Christmas. And then to say, actually to mark the day down and say, let's take a look when we're going to start getting presents and go, oh, look, you know, and again, whatever the holiday tradition is, whether you do it, you know, presents Christmas Eve on the 24th or do it on the 25th, or if you're Jewish and, you know, here this week you're going to be doing Hanukkah, and I don't know, again, if you're going to get a present today or a present, you know, one present for all the 8 days, whatever. This is something that you've, as a family, decided this is the day. You know, somebody says, well, when is this, you know, when am I going to have it? And so, well, let's go back to the calendar. And again, this is something very similar to what we just answered in the previous question, that the person can reference as often as they need to. And if somebody says, well, when is presents? And they go, well, let's go check and see when is presents. It may not make the question stop, but I think it'll start, the person has a different way, this young man or young woman has a way to have some sort of visual organizational cue by being able to say, okay, fine. And they can even check off the day, you know, have a marker there. And you, at the same time, you can also be self-reflective. It's really, really hard to wait. The other thing is, a lot of times there are kids who just like the experience of, like, tearing off the wrapping paper and this kind of thing. And so one way that I have, as I mentioned, at our center, we have three different categories of occupational therapists and physical therapists. They have taught me personally that to be really sensitive to the fact that a lot of times it's very hard for our kids to wait and they're experiencing a lot of anxiety. One way to organize is to give them different kinds of proprioceptive activities. I like to, there's a catalog company that I like to get a variety of different koosh balls, K-O-O-S-C-H, I believe is the spelling. The company is called Oriental Trading Company, and it's not an advertisement for this company. They just happen to have a variety of different koosh balls that I like to get. They're out of Los Angeles, California. And sometimes I will say, you know, it's really hard to wait, but when I squeeze a koosh ball or in different kind of proprioceptive input when I'm chewing gum or when I'm sucking on a lollipop, these are different ways to sort of calm my body and organize. And when I'm visually looking at my calendar and maybe I'm chewing some gum or squeezing my koosh ball, I can, or, you know, and again, or work on deep breathing, different kinds of relaxation techniques. It's just a little bit easier to wait until the day we can have those presents to open. But it doesn't mean it's going to make it easier. We're basically teaching tools to wait and to help with tolerance.
Yeah, I find that the opening two presents from the people that email into me written on this topic has to do with sensory stuff, as you're talking about, but also the fact that the sensory aspect where they just want to twiddle with the ribbon, so they stop from opening the present, which can be a very big disappointment when you're out with relatives. Mm-hmm. So another suggestion, as well as taking care of all the sensory stuff, is to actually practice unwrapping presents in the sense that if they know that their much favorite object in the world is actually wrapped up in that box,
right,
they're going to keep going till they get to that object. Mm-hmm. And if you can practice that a little bit before going, that also can be helpful.
Absolutely.
If that, you know, if they're getting stuck on the ribbon, still need, as you say, all that sensory stuff.
Absolutely. And I think that what you're reflecting, Chantal, is really the ability to go ahead and do role-playing, which I think is a huge piece to all the questions that are, you know, that are being asked this evening. A lot of times I'll have different experiences with families that come into my office, and we'll practice opening presents or waiting, or you know, what it's like when when you first have all the rhythm of school and then that stops, or the rhythm of work and that stops, and you have, you know, how do you tolerate different transitional issues, and we'll practice different strategies, what to do when. And that actually is, you know, very organizing, because then Chuck can kind of again go back into their minds and say, oh, now I have sort of a script to know what to do.
It's important to remind people, too, that it may a technique may seem like it's not working because you're not getting immediate results. Mm-hmm. But the point is that even if it doesn't work 100% this first holiday season, if you, again, the next time they'll remember back from the last time.
Mm-hmm.
And time, it does become strategy that works.
Right. And I think this is also as much for families as it is for the individual who's impacted. because the truth is, I think parents often feel helpless, especially when the children are in the middle of a meltdown and whatnot. And but basically, we're giving alternatives to giving them actual tools to say, well, you know, you could do this, that, and that, or you could do role playing. You could create visual maps. You could go ahead and give proprioceptive input. All these things so that there are active strategies for parents themselves not to feel so helpless. In the midst of a child's meltdown or, you know, incessant questions or intense anxiety and so forth.
Right. Now I'm going to switch more to another question, which has to do with actually the behavior of the child and the expectation of other family members that are around for a celebration. But before I do that, I'm going to read a little something from what I wrote about the holidays. That parents in the autism community, we often joke that we become more religious during the holiday season because we pray our children would behave while we are visiting relatives. We pray that they will show interest in their gifts and not just the ribbon. We pray that they will sit at the dinner table. We pray they won't hit the relative who tries to kiss them. And above all, we pray that we will have the strength to politely ignore the judgments passed upon us of behaving children. I guess we all do become a little more religious during the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a question from Julie in New Baden. How should we go about letting family members who aren't so close know why our son may behave in a certain manner? Also, is it appropriate to ask family members to lower their voices when speaking to our son at such an overwhelming event for him?
Mm-hmm.
You know, an event such as a family reunion or a dinner with lots of people present during the holidays.
Sure, sure. Well, first off, I want to applaud. I love your religious reference, because I think we do pray a lot, and I think, you know, parents of children with disabilities pray all the time, and particularly to try to, you know, that everybody wants to have a feeling that this holiday season my child will act a certain way. And I want, and this sort of leads into how to deal with extended family. One of the things that I'm recommending again is that, for me, spontaneous does not work, you know, meaning that you really have to, we're talking here now about helping to prepare a child for the upcoming holiday season. What I like to do is also prepare family. And one of the things is that you have the right as a parent to choose the kind of events that you will expose your child to. If the event is too large, you, A, have the right not to go, or you have the right to leave in the middle if it feels to you that it's becoming overwhelming, A. B, I like to go ahead and either phone call or meet or email the families that I'm going to be getting to. Sometimes I can do just sort of a universal email to what the families that are going to be at a certain event. And I explain to them well ahead of time that what's going on for my child, which is a big deal because I do have families who, so to speak, have never come out of the closet in terms of the issues for their child, and either don't take their child at all and sort of hide that failing, or have never shared this, and so the child will act out, and parents, the family members will point or whisper or want to know what's going on, and then the family feels terribly humiliated or embarrassed and so forth. So, again, I'm a big believer to alert people to what's going on. One of the difficult pieces is sometimes family members don't believe that an issue is there or have a hard time. And what I say to my families is, that's not really your problem. You know, if a parent, grandparent, great aunt, something is saying, no, you just have to be tougher on this kid, or when I was raising children, there was never such a thing as autism, and you know, so forth. Well, certainly, we are better diagnosticians now than we were, say, 50 or 60 years ago, and so it is very likely that no one talked about the word autism, you know, when this great aunt or somebody was a parent themselves. But along those lines is, that's not your problem. Your problem is to explain the situation to the extended family and then also give active suggestions, kind of your own wish list, how you would like the evening, you know, to go. It is absolutely okay to say, my son, aside from, say, experiencing autism, experiences something called auditory processing disturbance, meaning that loud noises really bother him. So I may ask you to sort of lower your voice when you speak, or speak a little bit slower when you're speaking to my son, because he'll appreciate that. and he may not like when there's all people kind of making an onslaught for him, because it'll feel kind of overwhelming. And you do have to be an advocate for your child. Given those kind of parameters, usually I have families who will tell me after the holiday that their extended family really appreciated the heads up. And we're trying to be very, very respectful. When I have families who just absolutely won't listen, what I will say to the parent, I say, well, then you have the right to leave. And you can also share that before that's going to happen. See, if I feel that my child is, in a situation where he is, just not that comfortable, we may leave early, and I want you to know it's not because the food is not good or we don't want to be with you, but my first job is to be an advocate and protect my child. And so I think
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's sort of a long-winded answer to a short question, but basically you have the right to protect your child, and I think if you give enough information ahead of time, then it's up to the family to decide how much they're going to take in, but you've done your job in terms of being the best advocate that you possibly can be for your child.
Another suggestion I always make is to ask if there couldn't be like a quiet room that's childproof.
Mm-hmm.
The child needs to retreat for some quiet time,
mm-hmm.
To escape from the commotion and
absolutely.
Noise.
Absolutely. It's a great idea. Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I helped a family create that because they we actually went to the grandparents' house ahead of time because they were planning on making the big Christmas tree and all the decorations, and the mother was afraid that that would be just too visually overstimulating for the child. And so what we ended up doing with this particular grandparent is that we also had a safe room for the impacted grandchild, and that when things got a little bit too overstimulating, then that child was given the right to go out with, adult supervision at this particular time to, get comfortable. And then when they felt able, they were able to go back and forth. And nobody had any, there were no problems because everybody had sort of been cued in as far as the kind of route this young man would take so he could feel comfortable and still participate into the best of his ability into the party celebrations.
Right. It's important to note also, you talked about it earlier about how, we think a lot about the kids, but we need to be thinking about the teens and also the adults as they are growing up. But sometimes these sensory challenges can get easier as they get older, but sometimes they still impact them in some way. And so some of these suggestions are things that are going to be useful or need to be carried out even when they're older.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, Chantal, we all have regulatory issues, We just mask them a little bit better. If you go to a kind of a boring lecture, people will tolerate it by maybe taking a walk and getting a drink of water and coming back. Or certainly people smoke as a way to get, a different kind of oral input, as a way to kind of negotiate a difficult time. And, for children and adults who have, issues, sensory issues, for instance, it's not that these issues are going to actually go away, but we have to sort of make it socially appropriate for them so that it becomes also developmentally appropriate. Can I give you an example of having nothing to do with the holidays that has to do with a young adult?
No, that's because I think these sensory things are very important, and I'm going to make a comment again after this as well, but
okay.
Go, please do.
Okay. So I share a story often, I mentioned, you talked about my upcoming presentations. I speak both nationally and internationally on floor time, and in part of one of my lectures, I mentioned recently a very pertinent example to what we're talking about as far as a young adult. I had a very high-functioning individual who I had seen for many years, all through her high school, and now she was about to go on to university. She's a very bright young lady. Now, she had organized by hiding her baby blanket in her backpack all through high school, and she felt somewhat ashamed by that, she also realized that she needed that sensory input to feel comfortable, particularly when she got stressed, and she, social situations, were very challenging for her. So what we decided to do together is she brought her baby blanket into the office, and she was really an honor because she allowed me to be the keeper of the blanket, basically. What we did is we cut up the blanket in 40 different squares. And we contacted this Oriental Trading Company, and I asked for keychains. And we made basically keychains, because I've seen koosh balls. I gave them the ideas because they have koosh balls on keychains. And I took the baby blanket, and we put that in the center of the keychain. And basically what happened is we created a sensory regulatory device, not unlike, say, a rosary, where any time that this young woman would get stressed, and she did often in university, was challenging on multiple levels, she could go ahead and rub it between her fingers, and that really calmed her. Now, she could also have attached this keychain to her belt loop or her backpack, and then every time the blanket piece would get worn, and it often did, we would go ahead and interchange the next piece that we had. And she was successfully able to navigate junior college initially, and then on to a regular university program.
Well, but what's going to happen when you run out of the 40 pieces?
Well, we were able to train. Now, that was a nice piece. The point was this. This is a need for her. And so we sort of sophisticated it up. So we went, after we started getting through about half of the pieces, she and I went shopping together. And we decided that it was okay to have something that felt like her baby blanket, but something that she could use in other times. And eventually what we were able to do was find material in a fabric store. And she was able to, we worked on this because she had initially some small motor issues, and these are things that she herself could make up later on her own. Meaning this, her sensory needs didn't necessarily go away, but she was ultimately able to do things to help herself so that she could regulate in a world that did oftentimes cause her a lot of stress. We don't discount the fact that these sensory needs exist. We want to create different strategies that are more age and socially appropriate so that it lends support to these individuals so that they can succeed at their optimum level of development and capacity.
Yeah, and you know, this is a little off the topic, but again, it relates our kids, whether they're young or they're adults, but California task force that you were talking about, I'm actually co-chairing the task force for the three counties here, San Diego, Inland, and Imperial.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my big concerns or thoughts about the transition and the training and employment, that's one area where they're not really taking into account yet the sensory issues. And so I think that's a real important piece that I hope that this task force, the work group in that area, can help remind people of, because it is, as you say, it doesn't just go away as they
mm-hmm.
get older.
Right, and we just have to sort of help people understand that these issues do continue to exist, but then, you know, be more creative in our strategies that are age appropriate.
Right, and also that's part of the whole issue with employment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I've helped some individuals where they have Asperger's and they loved their job at a hotel, but they couldn't work more than 2 or 3 days in a row. They
mm-hmm.
needed like a day to recuperate.
Mm-hmm.
And people thought that they were having a bad attitude. But once you go in and you explain to them that they actually needed that time to recuperate from all the sensory sensations and the overload that was really taxing them,
mm-hmm.
then they had the best employee ever. You know,
yeah.
They were able to work out a schedule.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That was able to accommodate this young man. And in that situation, it's just another example of how sensory issues can create situations where people can't work somewhere. But sometimes when people know about these things, they can work it into the situation.
Right. And this is what I'm talking about, going back to the holiday scene. When I have a lot of situations with families, and once the extended family is sort of told about this, they generally are more than less accommodating because they go, oh, well, now at least we know what to do, what's going on. And then generally the next question is, well, what can we do to help support? And so some of the things that I have to do is help my families get comfortable with the telling of you know, that something is
right.
going on for their child. And I think that's part and parcel to, you know, how to go ahead and make the holidays a positive experience for everybody.
That is a very good point, because a lot of times people do not feel comfortable telling. But you're right. You have to be able to feel that confidence mm-hmm. that you have the right to make these points.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, here's another question, and this one's from Jerry in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
The holidays are always a time of stress, but especially since our adopted autistic son joined our lives. One therapist suggested we not decorate as much for Christmas, since the disruption is probably causing the negative behaviors. We include him in the decorating and explain the reasons, but is there more ways of helping him cope without changing our traditions? His brothers love helping to decorate and would be disappointed if we changed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we began to sort of address those issues. And again, the first thing I would do is sit down with brothers because there's a lot of different pieces that are going on. One is the fact that this family has adopted an autistic child, and I don't know if they knew the child was autistic before they adopted the child, or that was a discovery, you know, along the way. And it sounds like they also have other children who were not adopted in the family. So I think, you know, there's lots of different issues that are going to be addressed here. You know, one is the adoption. One is the fact that, you know, brother that we adopted is autistic. And I like to explain to brothers and sisters, based on their level of capacity to understand what's going on, because oftentimes children are not told, you know, neurotypically developing SIBs, and that leads to a lot of confusion and resentment. And then when I've talked to parents, they say, well, you know, of course there's change. I know our brothers and sisters should have just known. And no child just knows. It just, sometimes you have to take the time to explain the differences. And again, the same thing. This is what we can do. This is the best way we can support our brother and sister who's having a tough time. In terms of actual concrete suggestions, one of the things that we just discussed is the fact that oftentimes the Christmas tree is in a room that's sort of right kind of in the middle, the dining room or the family living room. It sort of takes, you know, takes sort of the major center stage, which, you know, is appropriate in terms of, you know, what the holiday means for most families. But as you had suggested earlier, I think if a child has a safe room within the house, or if it's another family's house that you're going to be going for the holidays, that they can retreat to when they become overwhelmed. Because oftentimes there's a lot of overstimulation that can take place in terms of visual overstimulation. Sometimes if you buy a real tree, a natural tree, the smell, the pine smell, which makes it smell so good to you, could actually be noxious to our child on the spectrum. So that, again, they need a place where they can just go to decompress from a variety of different stimulation. Now, sometimes children don't even realize they're being overstimulated. So here's when they need parental support. No one knows a child as well as a mom and dad. And usually you know the signals when their children are getting to be too overexcited and unable to sort of keep it together themselves. That's when a parent has to intervene and say, you know what, I think we need a few minutes in our, and let's call the room something special, in our timeout room or something like in our quiet space, so it doesn't sound like it's negative. And have it like it's really kind of cozy and some a special sensory quiet place, like sometimes I suggest a beanbag chair, with a comfy, you know, something, a comfy blanket, something that gives this child, a comforting place. And I also, most importantly, have a clock. And if a child can't tolerate the sound of a timer going off, there are several clocks that don't have timers, and just sort of the minutes are passed, that there is no more, say, red color to the timing, so that you know that it's time to return. Because the most important thing is sometimes our kids get too comfortable leaving the scene, and our families get too comfortable not having the child there. And I really want to say, we're going to have a few quiet minutes, and we're going to take 5 or 7 or whatever the timing is that you feel is appropriate, and then we want you back. So we have to help the child sort of get used to the, you know, being part of it, but also, you know, say, I respect the fact that you need a few minutes to yourself.
Right. Okay, here's a good question from Louise in Oshawa.
Mm-hmm.
I want to enjoy the holidays, but they are just so stressful. When we go to any event or family gathering, we seem to always spend the entire time chasing around after our two young daughters who both have autism, and we aren't able to relax and chat with friends or family members. Then we end up having to leave early. It's so overwhelming for the kids and us. Any suggestions about how to have a more relaxing holiday? How do we make it through and remain sane through all the events and craziness of the holidays?
Okay. Great questions. And what I'm hearing is that there's not one but two children who have autism.
Right.
So
they're young. They were just, even if they didn't have autism, you'd have two young children
who are having a hard time navigating. So the first question I have is, it sounds like this family goes out to the event, to the family gathering, and I'm going to make a suggestion, and you know, the parent has to share with me whether that's appropriate or not, because I don't know, sometimes it's actually more comforting for children to have the event at their house, like kind of their turf. So I don't know if sometimes that can be ever arranged where the family would be the people who would be hosting. So they could have actually a little bit more control in terms of how long the party is going to be, how many people are going to be at the party, and so forth. The other thing is, which I think is so important, families cannot do this by themselves, okay? And whether it's, you know, hiring a neighborhood child as a babysitter, or looking to the state-funded program, Regional Center for some respite time or something, if you have to sort of decide what you want from the evening. If it's a time where you would like to also visit, then you have to be able to create an extra set of eyes and a pair of hands to be with your children. And that might be either yourself or your partner, your spouse, to say, okay, you know what, I'm going to, you know, sit here and socialize with friends for half an hour, and then you're on, you know. So you take turns, or you bring your aide, your sitter with you, so that you can have someone who can help you do that. Or you just sort of make a decision for yourself, saying, you know what, I know that my kids really need me right now, and so I probably won't be able to socialize as much as I would like when I have my kids. Maybe we need to make a different kind of date to do so when the children are occupied at another time. Because, again, even if you didn't have kids with special needs, children who particularly don't see family members very often, or they're out of their own environment, and again, different transitions and different tensions, don't always behave the best. And one of the ways that children tell us that they need to leave is to create kind of a tumult until finally the noise or the chaos gets so loud the parent goes, okay, I have to get out of here. Then the parent gets frustrated, but really the child has been asking all along in their own special way, I need help here. This is overwhelming.
Right.
And so sometimes, what I'm saying is, I think sometimes parents have to sort of decide for themselves what kind of event this is going to be. And if they themselves need some social time, they have to create the environment that's going to allow them to do so. So in other words, they're going to have to bring some help along so that they can do that if they also want to bring their children. The other thing is, instead of coming to a party, you know, midstream, sometimes it's helpful if they come to the party first. So the child has a way to sort of scope out the area. And then they can say, you know, we're going to be here for an hour or so, because that's what our children can tolerate. And then say to the family members who are coming after, again, either we're going to go home and put our kids down with our sitter and then come on back, if that's physically possible in terms of the proximity of the holiday and the distance between homes, or we'll make another day at another time, which will be an adult time for us.
Right. Yeah, those are all options. I have to say, though, as a parent, that it is particularly difficult around the holidays to have help. I mean, I have at least 8 people fully trained to be support staff for my son, and mm-hmm. there are certain days you're not going to have anybody.
Oh, no, and believe me, I get it. The holidays is really tough. But you know what? Sometimes, like, for instance, at our center, we have people who work as interns, and one of the first questions I say to them is, tell me when you can work and when you can't work. And I will say to them, this family particularly needs you on the weekends, or this family particularly needs you on Christmas. What, even before we started the relationship, what kind of availability do you have? So that, you know, not to say that, of course, there aren't surprises and people have different changes in schedules, but I also try to, you know, create as little surprise as possible, because I know I hear what you're saying, and you do need support, and you know, sometimes things happen and parents are on their own, and of course that happens, but I try to also create an environment and hire people who might have that flexibility in their schedule, because this is the kind of flexibility that our families need.
Right. It was kind of a running joke in my house for quite a few years between all the different sitters and respite workers and tutors and support staff about I had to have certain people from all different religions so that all the religions were covered.
Absolutely. No, this is not a joke.
I will
100%. I will tell you that my support staff ranges. We come in all different flavors and sizes, so to speak,
sure.
In terms of religious denominations, particularly because I have a Jewish, guys and gals who have no problem working on Christmas, and in contrast, I have individuals who have followed different religious observances, and they have no problem, assisting on, Jewish holidays and so forth. But to my families, but absolutely, we take. I specifically ask those as my screening questions in terms of what are your sensitivities and when could you work, and this is what
right.
our families particularly need. But yes, absolutely.
Okay, here's a question from Tina Moreno in Soho. I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing sometimes the cities correctly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How can I take my son anywhere? He doesn't like to go where there is a big crowd. Then my nephew starts him up, and I can't control him. What to do?
Okay. Okay.
So this is more like on the spot. What can you do when someone is kind of setting up the... person in a big crowd situation where already that child is feeling overwhelmed?
Okay. Well, first off, you can leave. Okay? I mean, this is the thing where I think so many of my families don't understand or feel embarrassed or so forth. One of the first things you sort of have to give up is this sort of sense that you're going to be embarrassed. Because basically what I'm asking you to do is be the best advocate for your child. And oftentimes, many kids, again, you don't have to be autistic, many kids get overwhelmed in big crowds, okay? And so if you can't control it because suddenly you're in a situation and suddenly there's a lot of people, you can do lots of different strategies. One is you can leave, okay? And if people say something, that's too bad. It's just going to be the other people's problem, not yours necessarily. The other thing is that you can go ahead and take your child and excuse yourself. Let's go try to find a safe spot, in this area that you're going to feel a little bit more comfortable and see if your child can't calm down. The situation says it seems like in addition to the big crowd, there was a nephew who, started him up, whatever that means. So I'm not sure if this is sort of a situation where the nephew knows that, if I just do a couple things, I can get my cousin to, kind of get jazzed, and that's sort of funny to see him act out. In which case, I need to meet with the nephew at another time and say, hey, you know what? That's not cool. Let me tell you exactly what's going on with your cousin, and have that child's parent around as well to help sort of enforce kind of the rules. And that when your cousin is here, this is the way we have to be, and kind of lay, especially, I don't know the age of the child, but to sort of lay down the rules. And if that parent is there as well, to emphasize that this is really serious stuff and it's not a game. Because a lot of times, children don't understand if they sort of see a child kind of rev up and go, well, that's kind of funny. I can kind of get that child to kind of, jazz up a rather boring afternoon if he's going to have a meltdown. And it doesn't feel good. It doesn't certainly feel good to the parent. It doesn't feel good to the child. And as I said, that parent has the right to create the safest place for that child and remove themselves from the situation. It can be temporary or it can be just the rest of that day.
Okay. Those are some good suggestions.
Thank you.
I'm looking down here at some other questions. Okay. Here, this is a question from Isra in Norway. Actually, it's two questions,
mm-hmm.
and I'll start with one of them because it explains more about her son. I have a 3-year-old boy. He has autism. I have a problem when I have visitors and my husband is not around, that he goes to the visitor's personal space and asks them for attention, and if they ignore him, he gets angry and upset, and he starts throwing objects at their faces. What do you suggest I do? I have another child who's 5 years and 10 months old.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's the first question. And the second question is, what do I do when they're in a gathering and her 3-year-old boy finishes his food, but yet interrupts the guests and is screaming and asking for their food, although she thinks he's definitely had more than enough food to eat?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Gatherings here.
Yes, okay. Well, I'll tell you the common theme in both questions that I'm hearing is that this child, even at the age of 3, is a pretty smart little kiddo because he has learned that if he screams, he probably gets what he wants, you know, whether it is, you know, more food or attention, okay? And so we have to do a couple things here. One of the things we have to do is try to understand what is fueling this little guy. And again, to understand that even though he's 3 years old, you know, chronologically, he's probably developmentally a little bit younger. So I have to approach him kind of as a younger child and figure out, you know, what is his underlying individual difference, that neurological piece of that eye in terms of the DIR profile, and then through my relationship help regulate him and move and help him get to the place where he can move forward in the most developmentally appropriate, you know, fashion. So the first thing, I'm going to go backwards. I'm going to talk about the food issue first, and then we'll talk about the attention. The first thing in terms of the food, what happens with children who, it's interesting, it sounds like this child eats his food and then screams because he wants more. I usually have situations where children have a lot of feeding concerns because they don't like so many foods because they are orally defended, again, because of sensory processing issues. One of the things that we have at our center is an occupational therapist who specializes in feeding problems, and she actually works hand-in-hand with a nutritionist on board because not only do we have to work on the actual feeding problems, but we also educate families because a lot of my families don't know about how to regulate the intake of food for their children, what it is to have a family dinner, how to really what to feed their children, you know, to begin with. But in contrast to this little boy who screams for food because he's never really full, one of the things to realize with kids who are autistic is all autistic children also have a regulatory disorder, meaning they don't take cues from the environment like you and I might, so that this little boy is not reading his body correctly. He doesn't ever really know when he is full. So secondary to this actual problem, one of the treatments that might have to go on is having him work with an occupational therapist and perhaps a nutritionist to help him understand what full and empty actually mean. And they can do it visually, for instance, like playing with balloons, filling it with water. And, you know, when the balloon is really swollen, that means full, just like the tummy is full after it eats. And we have to wait a certain amount of time before the tummy is empty. And, again, teach them how to use a clock. And this is how long we have to wait. And again, have a clock with or without a bell, depending on what the child can tolerate auditorily, to say, and after this amount of time goes by, then we can eat something else in terms of tolerating how long it takes to feel, to be able to digest and empty enough to get more food. The thing I would not do is actually, you know, support the screaming because this child goes for food on guest plates. I guess the question that can't really be addressed here because I'm not speaking to the parent in person is, does the same kind of screaming goes on when there's not a guest? Because one of the things that sort of makes my ear perk up is, like, and this goes into the second question, that when, if I remember correctly, this mom's husband is not around, this is when the 3-year-old acts out. And so my question is this acting out just simply for guests, both in terms of taking food off of the plates of guests and throwing objects in guests' face when they come to visit, or does this happen to everybody in the house? So one of the thoughts is, what is it about having guests in the house that causes this particular child so much upheaval? Again, is it because it's new? Is it a transition? Is there a thought that when guests come, you know, sort of mom and dad's attention leaves me and that causes me too much anxiety? And that's the case. What I would do is, again, help him with a social story in anticipation of the guest who's coming. One of the things that we can do, if you have pictures of the guest happens to be a family member or somebody from the office or whatever, is to have pictures ahead of time and almost create a storybook. You know, tonight we're going to have company, and the company's name is, you know, Mr. and Mrs. X, and they look like this. And when we're going to have dinner, and then, you know, and sort of really go ahead step by step and create the evening for the child so he should know. And then also put into place in this social story what is what we're going to do and what is not allowed to do when you have guests. When you have guests, you can come ahead and you can say, hi, my name is, and I'm, you know, offer, would you like to play with so-and-so, a toy of mine or something? What we don't do is we don't take food off somebody's plate. We also don't hurt anybody's body. And, you know, again, address all those issues that are ahead of time that the mother has seen happen when this child it has to deal with the anxiety associated, I'm guessing, with visitors coming to the home. But I don't want to ignore the fact that there is a 5-year-old in the house as well as another 10-month-old. So the mom sounds like she's pretty overwhelmed with already 3 kids, one of whom has special needs. So, again, you can't do it by yourself. So I'm wondering whether or not sometimes it might mean to have a set of hands, a sitter, an aide to be able to actually navigate the 5-year-old and the 10-month-old so that she can create this kind of social stories and planning with her 3-year-old. And actually, if the 5-year-old is up to it, have him be part of the scenario so he can also help him plan and maybe give suggestions. What are different things we can do when the company comes and so forth?
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
It does sound like he has a mind of his own.
I'm sorry, say it again.
He does sound as if he has a mind of his own.
He does sound like he has a mind of his own, but it also sounds, between you and I, Chantal, is that his screaming has worked for him.
That's what I mean. It's so smart,
You
said at the beginning.
Yeah.
That.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the things which we have to do is we have to, renegotiate this situation where, he's not being rewarded, because basically if he screams and parents eventually just give in because they don't want to be embarrassed or they're just too loud or chaotic in the house, basically he just learned to just turn it up to that octave.
Okay, here's a great question from Lindsay James in Freeport.
Okay.
My son likes belts and strings, but he already has too many of them for me to buy him more. I never know what to buy him for Christmas or his birthday. He doesn't really play with toys, but he loves to watch movies, mainly cartoons. But that still only limits me to belts, strings, and movies to buy him. Do you have any suggestions? This is a great question because I know this is true of most people with children with autism. Because, you think you should buy these educational toys or toys that would really help him out. But when it comes down to it, when you have a stemmer, my son...
Mm-hmm.
A few things that really make them happy.
I can appreciate that. Well, again, one of the things, I guess the first thing I keep, and I don't mean to sort of, beat an issue until it's kind of dead in the face, or blue in the face, rather, but I really want families to understand kids do or don't do something because it feels good to their or bad to their body. In other words, they'll do something because it feels really good, or they won't do something because it doesn't feel good to their body. And there's a reason why children stim, off of belts or strings or anything else, because it really feels good. And so one of the things I'd like to find out is, can we do one of the basic tenets of floor time? Can we go ahead and follow the initial motivation of a child but expand and extend on those elements, meaning that you mentioned that he likes belts and string and movies. Okay. So the question is, I think what happens when you have a child with special needs, they ask you to be sort of more than creative. As a matter of fact, in Los Angeles, if anybody ever has the opportunity, I know that they have this in other cities as well, but we have wonderful theater. In particular, there's a theater company called Groundlings, which is improvisational theater. And I think what happens when you have a child, on the spectrum, it sort of behooves you to become an improvisational player, meaning you got to take what you got and then sort of almost as if you're taking from nothing, make it into something purposeful and meaningful. Meaning, if your child goes ahead and he likes belts and strings and movies and particularly cartoons, is there a way to combine it but make these different elements socially acceptable? Let me give you an example just sort of popped into my head. If there's a movie that came out fairly recently called Up, one of the latest Disney movies, and in that movie there's a character named Russell. And Russell, there's an element where there are strings in there because he's sort of holding balloons, or balloons are attached to the house that he and this elder gentleman are part of. They're having this adventure. So what I'm wondering about is there a character in the movie that the child really would identify with, that somehow that could be part of, the Christmas gift, that could also like strings or belts or something like this? So that you might be associated with a figure character that makes sense rather than simply stemming on a belt or a string by itself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. You're associating it with something Someone he admires.
Someone he admires in the movie that he really finds, but also has to do with Belt, with some kind of a, whatever stimulation and pleasure he's getting out of belts and strings, again, because sometimes also it's about just holding something in their hands to get organized as a way to reduce anxiety. And so can I replace that item? And I'll go back to my young woman who replaced, her baby blanket with this, this keychain, this kind of, so to speak, rosary keychain. Can you replace the same kind of experience that a child has with a belt or a string with something else that is more socially appropriate that they could just hold in their hand as a way to stem and organize? Because, again, I don't want to take away something because it serves as a purpose to help reduce anxiety. But if I can change it around so that it becomes more of a socially appropriate object, then I'm still allowing this child to get his sensory needs met, but at the same time, I'm putting him in a situation which allows him to be part of a more appropriate reciprocal relationship.
Right, but I guess the question is when it's Christmas or Hanukkah or their birthday, you're trying to give them something that they like already, not something that is going to give him more stress or that he hasn't yet attached to, perhaps.
Well, you start off with what they're interested in. So, again, let's try to figure out that something that, in other words, if a child likes the strings, how can we update it? So I'll give you an example, just to sort of, again, spontaneously comes to my mind. If somebody likes string, instead of just giving him string, could we give him a yo-yo as an example? In other words, there is that's kind of a hard thing, especially for small motor, but it can be taught, and it is a way to sort of making it more socially appropriate. Does that make sense as well?
My son loves patterns.
Okay.
So he likes on the rugs, he likes patterns wherever.
Mm-hmm.
I have a great book at the bookstore that was a book on patterns, and it actually also had a DVD in it that had patterns so you could actually print them out. Well, mm-hmm. We still haven't printed them out,
mm-hmm.
but patterns on the book pages also had an explanation of where they came from, so then it also became, we could read to him about where the patterns came from and why they had those patterns and whether they were wallpaper patterns or rug patterns or,
See, now that's a beautiful example of floor time. He liked patterns and you found a socially, you took his initial motivation, but then it was your creativity, your improvisational skills to extend and expand something that he loved into something socially appropriate. So that's what I'm asking to see for Christmas or a birthday present.
Maybe there's books that have pictures of belts and strings or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, I'm just thinking that way because also my son loves to carry something. He needs an item to transition with,
mm-hmm.
and I have no problem with that, but I don't like it when he is constantly wanting to stem because I can tell when the stem is helping him and when the stem is not helping him. And mm-hmm. so if he's in a high school mainstream class, I'd much rather he find another way than stemming on a string because that usually becomes something that he gets lost in, if you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean.
And so but that's the point.
That's where I've been able to transfer it to books.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying, is that we're looking for socially appropriate ways to acknowledge the fact that the need is there, but not to create an escape.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Maybe this person can find things that have pictures of belts and strings on them or that they're part of something like a yo-yo, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
Like some backpacks also have, or bags have those kind of belts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Right, exactly. In other words, you can have, there's certain kind of clothing that also have like cargo pants and different places, you can create a more age-appropriate type of extension of an original stem, but now is actually a socially appropriate method of getting him into a reciprocal relationship with you.
Right, like I'm thinking about here, hoodies in California, I don't know
mm-hmm.
Where Freeport is, but the hoodies in California, they always have strings in the hoodies,
mm-hmm.
and that is the greatest emergency string ever,
mm-hmm.
because there on the hoodie.
There you go. There you go. Exactly. And you know,
so I could buy a. When I was first started buying hoodies for my son, mm-hmm. when he wasn't picking out his clothes,
yeah,
he was focusing on the string
uh-huh.
and on the pattern.
Right.
Now he focuses on the whole thing.
Right.
So he started out with the pattern.
Right.
And string as being why he likes the hoodie.
Right, right. The other thing is to take string again and make it a social. What I want is to have a relationship with that child. So I don't want the stemming, because a lot of times stems are very self-absorbing, okay? So I want to say, I'll go ahead and I'll do the string with you, but I want to go ahead and make a game together like Cat's Cradle, okay? So you're working on small motor skills, which is often difficult for our kids, as well as the fact they have to do with another person. So this is two things that are difficult for our kids, but it's still having to do with string.
Right.
So, again, taking an idea that is originally your child, even if it feels like very innocuous, and then having to be creative to figure out how am I going to do something that's going to take this original idea but make it more complex while still keeping the basic theme of the child's interest intact.
I remember when we used to make those pot holders with
mm-hmm.
those, like, stringy...
Sure, sure. That was part of everybody's camp experience. You got it.
Yeah, there's things like that that, I mean, there's more to up-to-date. I'm sure any teenager
right.
could say what they do in camp now that involves strings, but things like that, too, could
sure,
be fun.
I think actually you built it on a loom, right, which I know they still have at any craft store. Exactly. So this is an idea to go to a craft store and say, you know what, my child likes string. What kind of, what we, and if there's, you know, and they may have small motor issues. So what do you have that would be not too hard for my child to learn how to do, but still would be embracing of the fact that the theme that he loves string?
Right. Now, here's a very good question. I don't know if you can help this person. This is Jane Tipton from Long Beach,
mm-hmm.
Long Beach, California.
Mm-hmm.
Are there programs to help low-income families on the spectrum during the holidays? I only know of one off the top of my head, and that's the TACA, Talk About Curing Autism Now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you look up their website, I think that they have, because I know they routinely ask all of us in the autism community to donate what we can so that they can help families who need help during the holiday season.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's Talk About Curing Autism Now.
Mm-hmm. And I would actually add, a few more different large agencies that I've seen. For instance, because of my association with autism, I get a lot of emails from major support groups like Cure Autism Now,
right.
Autism Society of America, Autism mm-hmm. Speaks. These are different organizations that do offer oftentimes low-fee or free support groups. And one of the things I think you can actually also Google is, different programs for families who have children on the spectrum that are no cost, low cost or no cost, and see what, oftentimes local organizations, like for instance in Los Angeles, is a Foothill Autism Society, and they often have low cost or no cost events that parents are welcome, to come to. Also, again, I don't know exactly if you've reached out to regional centers. That's a state-run agency that can offer different programs, and they usually have programs associated with, low-fee or no-fee kinds of programming for the holidays. There's also, again, I don't know in terms of religious affiliation. I know, for example, for the Hanukkah holidays, the Jewish Family Service has a program in Los Angeles called HaMerkaz, HaMerCaz, as well as Friendship Circle, which another Jewish organization, Chabad, Chabad, runs in terms of special needs. And these are very low-fee or no-fee kinds of special programs that are run on weekends and on holidays, particularly for both children with special needs and their families.
Those are all good suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
I would also reach out, yes, to the local Autism Society of America chapters and see if they have any resources in your area.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. All right, here's Sylvie in Ottawa. Hi, my 9-year-old daughter with ASD always gets really stressed for about 1 month prior to Christmas and then is affected for about 1 month following. She has it in her mind that she is Santa, and so she plans, makes or tries to get the perfect gift for everyone she knows. She puts a lot of pressure on herself to get everything perfect. She obsesses about it, and this is all she wants to do. She even wakes up before sunrise in order to have more time to prepare the gifts. When Christmas comes around, she pays special attention to everyone's reactions to the gifts she gives them, and then she puts herself down when people don't appreciate them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Well, actually, you know, this mom's daughter sounds like she's pretty high-functioning, you know, that she's really thinking, you know, about Christmas and sort of and planning. And consequently, I see a lot of times with our very high-functioning kids on the spectrum, they do get stressed for Christmas. One of the things that I'm noticing is that she gets stuck. She believes in her mind that she is Santa and that she has to make a perfect gift, as you mentioned, for everybody she knows. Often what goes hand-in-hand with children with an autism spectrum disorder is actually obsessive-compulsive disorder. And again, these are ways to deal with tension and with anxiety. Everything has to be just right and just so. So one of the things, if it really gets out of control, and again, I'm not an advocate for medication. I'm an advocate for kids. But if I find a child's functioning really is, a child is unable to function during a part of the year as a consequence of the transition just gets too great, this is when maybe I'll work with a parent to suggest that, you know, what are the parental feelings about medication, and have they thought about that as a direction if, again, the child is really stuck and needs some help to sort of help calm and sort of regain their ability and composure. But without necessarily going to the root of medication, if that's something the families choose not to do, because, again, with all certainly Western traditional medications, there are side effects, and the parents may choose not to do it all or don't want to go the route of homeopathic or Eastern medication, as an example. One of the things, again, what we can do is create what we've been talking about many times tonight, which is to create a social story ahead of the game and sort of, and before this 1 month prior to Christmas, and say, you know, Christmas is coming. Let's talk about presents, for instance, and how, you know, I always think that I'm supposed to have a certain present for everybody, and it has just to be so. But my mom told me that that's not my job, that I'm 9 years old, and my job is to, you know, whatever a 9-year-old is appropriate to do. And if I do want to give a present, I can give a present to so-and-so. But that it doesn't have to be perfect, because I don't know anything that's perfect. And, you know, again, you know, having a 4-to-6-page story where the child is sort of relieved of the talks about and relieved of the anxiety to have to do something exactly so. And then you can also talk about the fact that, you know, people's expectations may be this way or that way, so she doesn't have to, you know, and even if somebody doesn't like my present, that's okay too. Again, so that's one piece, that an active suggestion that I would give.
Very good. It's all about expectations, too, for the holidays. I mean, aside from this young girl, mm-hmm. a lot of things that I'm hearing from people and also from your answers is that parents have expectations, the children have expectations, and the relatives have expectations. And mm-hmm. I think that as parents, we have to be so careful to you know, not try to live up to certain expectations that we may have put there that perhaps are unrealistic.
Oh, absolutely.
Trying to keep up with everyone else's expectations of an event.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think, you know, too often in our minds, when you talked about, you know, Thanksgiving and you know, I wish it was many months before so I could have some downtime to kind of get ready for Christmas, I think we all have this image in our minds of this perfect Norman Rockwell painting. And, you know, the reality of most families is far from that idealistic situation. So it may even start, not even in terms of our children with special needs, but what is the parent's expectation of the holidays, period, and then add into the mix a child with special needs. How do you maneuver within that?
But I think there's an aspect that we haven't brought up yet or discussed yet, is mm-hmm. that For many people who the holidays are a special time, and it is a time for getting together, and so when they're having all these concerns with their children, it brings about a deep sadness and a sorrow because even though, you know, we have these hard situations, even if we didn't have kids with autism, where you have expectations that can't be met, but the fact that your child is not enjoying the holiday the way everyone else is, the fact that you are not free to enjoy the holiday the way you normally would. You know, as you say, you have to think about having a respite person come with you, or you have to think about leaving early and coming late. You know, after a while, it gets, it's really sad because those are the moments that you cherish and you always hope to cherish with your child.
Right.
So what kind of advice do you give parents in dealing with those?
Well, it's basically what we're talking about is acceptance. You know,
it's not just acceptance. It's because it's also feelings of sadness that people have.
But that's part
of it. Meanwhile, you can be going towards the acceptance, but you still have those feelings of sadness.
Oh, no question whatsoever. No question. But that is part of acceptance. In other words, when I think of acceptance, I think that it's a process. And then the process, first off, has many, many elements in it, including being very sad and very angry and maybe blaming and denying and hiding and there's no particular sequence to finally getting to coming to terms with this. And it doesn't mean that you don't go back and forth and you think, okay, I finally am accepting this, but a situation happens where I get horribly embarrassed, or I had, you know, hopes and it didn't happen and I feel sad and depressed again, or I have come to terms with my teenager who has autism, but then I see, you know, my sister's children who are, you know, smaller, and 2 and 3 year olds who are doing things that my 17-year-old will never be able to do, and I get thrown back into depression. There's no question that this sadness, this coming to terms, is an ongoing, if not a life process, because as you hit certain milestones, and certainly holiday time, when you have other family members and you're going out of your own routine so that you can sort of see contrast, that, you know, that sort of puts everything right back into your face. I think it is also about giving the opportunity for parents ahead of time to reflect in their own minds what are their expectations and talk about, you know, the feelings of loss and sadness and frustration and anger, you know, that they have because they would just love to be able to go to the holiday like everybody else, or not have to plan so extensively, and you know, all the different elements that we've been talking about, the fact that really we can't be spontaneous with the holiday, and we can't take time off to say, okay, tonight just don't be autistic for me, would you, you know, please, because it doesn't work like that. And so one of the things that I offer to parents is something about self-care, because I don't think we talk about that enough. And, you know, I mentioned that briefly, that parents themselves, you tend to get overwhelmed by their own personal expectation of the holiday. And what ends up happening in those situations is it tends to exaggerate and exacerbate, I think, the situation. So what I offer also is that within all these groups that we've been talking about, you know, so, you know, there are parent support groups, other families who have done the journey, who are willing to sit down together and talk about, you know, holiday time, and just to hear another person kind of say, yeah, I had the same experience, and this is what I did, or, you know what, there's no answer, it's just crummy, you know, and just to acknowledge and validate that experience, that makes a parent feel, I think, a little bit less alone. The other thing, which I think is really, really important, there's got to be a time when you're not dealing with your kids. And, you know, again, I don't believe in super moms and dads. I don't believe in perfect moms and dads. I don't think there is such a thing as perfect and super. And I think that sometimes gets our own expectations and sets us up for exhaustion and failure. Parents, particularly in holiday time, have to be able to pencil in for themselves downtime on an individual basis as well as a couple time for themselves and their partner, so they can get away and just not have to deal with the, you know, the overt stressors of holiday and having a child on the spectrum and having other kids that they have to negotiate, and just take care of themselves and have a little bit of downtime, fun time, quiet time, whatever that they need, so that they can do some self-care and recharge their own batteries so that they can be available for all the demands of the holidays and thereafter.
Good point. Not always so easy to do, but good point.
No. And a lot of my parents, they find it nearly impossible to do because they are such good parents, and they just, you know, like I can't take downtime. And I say, you know what, you got to take downtime. How are we going to pencil that in for you?
The reality of the respite people and the babysitters, because, you know, as the kids are out of school for 2 weeks, and I don't care how well organized you are when it comes to respite people, mm-hmm. the people work for you, they want downtime too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when your kids in school, you can do the self-care. When they're not in school, it is very hard unless you're a wealthy person with a live-in mm-hmm. who's going to be there during the holidays to take those times.
It is, but you know, yeah, this is like I shared with you about the groundling, you know, idea in terms of being, you know, asking you to sort of be extra creative. There, what I have found, for instance, in Los Angeles County, I don't know if in San Diego, there are almost all the high school students that I've worked with in both in regular high schools, they have 30 hours of community service that they have to commit to. And so what I do is go to school counselors, and I said, listen, I have a lot of families who could use support. And can this count as these 30 hours towards community service? And then what I go ahead and do is I will train, you know, high school or for.
But there are people like my son that I could not leave with a high school student.
No,
he's not dangerous or anything, but he has toileting issues. That's not something you're going to leave.
No. I understand that.
Well, you know, it seems like, you know, if there is, and I know a lot of people like me who mm-hmm. you know, are very resourceful, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's just hard. I have a daughter who's almost 18. I can leave her at certain times with my son, but I can't certain times of the day when I know he might possibly have a toileting accident. The toileting accident is a sensory thing again.
Mm-hmm. Sure. No, there's no question. And I don't mean to minimize and say there's an easy answer for all these tough situations.
No, but I'm just putting it out there because I didn't want people out there to be listening to say, oh, no, you know, because for some people there are options like that, and those options could work. Mm-hmm. Like my daughter does work with the boy who's 11 who has Asperger's, and she's perfect with him, mm-hmm. you know, and that's mm-hmm. perfect. She could help a lot of people like that. But
Chantal, I don't mean to cut you off at all, and I appreciate the fact that you're putting out, you know, it's not just...
I just don't want people listening to feel like if they have a child like who can't be left, that they're like, oh my gosh, am I the only one with this?
They are certainly not. But what I want to share with you, and I'm really addressing one part of your initial question, was, for instance, like the holiday time. So
right.
Let me share with you that there are children who have different religious schedules. And so that if you have like 2 weeks during Christmas time, but then you have other schools who are not taking their breaks because their religious affiliation, it's not a holiday time that they can, so they are available to go ahead.
Right.
And do so. That what I'm saying is, this is where I'm asking you to be creative on that level, okay? Meaning, we joked about having different, you know, interns of different religious affiliations. You have to be that creative at times, but you do find people who are more available than you imagine, okay? Because that particular holiday isn't something that they identify with, so that they would be available. But at the same time, I don't want to minimize situations as you're suggesting, like your son's, which really is, you know, you need a specialized person to be with him, and just can't leave somebody who is a well-meaning high schooler, you know, to sit and provide respite.
But I do have to say, those high school people are really wonderful for even for people like my son. They may not be able to, you know, babysit or be alone with him, but they're great for the socializing and hanging.
Right. Thank you.
Under supervision, even, you know.
Right. But, and the reason I bring that up again is because I don't think you have to break the bank. Meaning, a lot of families are saying, you know, I don't have the money for a sitter. So I offer this as an option because it doesn't cost families anything, and also what happens is that it is the advantage of the student because they get those 30 credits that they need anyway in terms of going ahead and providing services. You know, so that's really the other piece is also to do cooperative babysitting, where especially with other families who have special needs, who are
right.
familiar with dealing with difficult kids and can certainly tolerate and know what to do and a little bit more savvy because this is their life experience as well, and they'll be happy to help because they know themselves that, you know, next Tuesday they get their night off, so to speak.
Right, and also they know exactly what kind of things to look out with for your child.
Exactly, exactly. But I did want to thank you because I did not want to reflect at all that, you know, that there are, you know, there's a one blanket answer for everybody, so without a question.
And also in these times, it's getting harder. Even in the state of California where we have regional centers, the regional centers are cutting the respite and they're cutting the social programs. And, well, you know, from being on the task force to what extent that's happening. So we all are having to be creative.
Exactly.
Which is why we have the task force. And so individually, we also need to help each other more, just like everyone else has to in this economy.
Exactly, exactly.
That's really... trying to look at the bright side of the economy is that I think, especially around the holidays, people are being more thoughtful about what kinds of gifts they're giving to people, and they're giving more of themselves, going mm-hmm. back to that, what we mm-hmm. used to do in the days.
mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. And here's another answer. In other words, if somebody's trying to say, what can I give to your family or to your child or something, and they might say, you know what, I need some babysitting time. I need somebody to come in and give me, you know, you want to do something really, commit 5 hours over the next month, you know,
right.
to come in and, you know, or even, and not even deal with my special needs kids. Help me with my typical developing kids because I feel really guilty that I never can take, you know, here's my you know, 5-year-old twins and my 6-year-old. I don't know, during that holiday time, it's going to be really tough for me. Could you take them to the zoo or something special that they want to do? And that would be
right.
wonderful as an example.
Good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a question from Diane in Burnt Hills, New York. How do we get our son, who is 6 with PDD and OS, to settle down and enjoy the here and now of the holiday and not focus on what is next?
Okay. Again, we have to sort of understand what is going on. Usually what happens to our kids is because, again, of this individual neurological differences, they have a lot of anxiety because they don't get the reassurances that typical kids get from just watching their mother's body language or hearing the message, because they might have you know, receptive language problems where they can't quite understand the message from their parents. So they don't, they're always sort of on edge because they are always, and they're always not sure what's the next step. So consequently, I see my kids get very anxious, go, what's next, what's next? Because they're always anticipating because I just don't get a sense of reassurance. So what I like to do then is use, as I've mentioned earlier, a visual map of this is what's happening and create a schedule. And if a child goes, but what's next? And they go, well, here's what's happening. This is happening from 4 to 5. Well, what's after that? Well, this is what's happening from 5 to 6. What's after that? And I said, well, we've decided to only do the calendar up to 6 o'clock, you know, or whatever it is. And then you have that social story that sort of supplements the visual map to say, and it's okay.
Right.
Okay. So one of the things that I think parents get involved with is they sort of follow up with, you know, the perseverations of the children without understanding that this is just a form of anxiety. And so we have to support with our relationship that individual neurological issue by the visual maps, by the social stories, by maybe having a child in our lap as we're reviewing this, because that's proprioceptive input which automatically comes and helps a child feel more grounded. And usually that will be enough to have the child, you know, just sort of tolerate the fact that sometimes in life there's a lot of ambiguity.
Yeah, you know, in my the last book that I had published by Penguin, which was called Autism Life Skills,
mm-hmm.
I interviewed adults on the spectrum from all people who were just typers and nonverbal to people with Asperger's,
mm-hmm.
Impacted but not perhaps as severely or differently, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing everyone said that was the hardest was the transitions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's the whole point of what's happening next, what's happening next. That creates all this anxiety because they're not quite sure if they're going to be able to handle what comes next. And
how to navigate, sure. Uh-huh.
These visual maps and these explaining what's going to happen next gets rid of a lot of that worry.
Right,
and
right.
They said if there's just one thing that you could do to help them is to prime them, to let them know what's going to happen next and to get over that fear of worrying
right.
about what's going to be happening next.
Right. And this is why I really love, you know, all kinds of variations of Carol Gray's work with social, you know, social
right.
stories. So you can sort of plan it, and then that person can have it with. And then a lot of times I like to laminate the social story so that you can use them again and again, and then have a marker where the child can sort of check off, oh, okay, we did this, so, you know, that's done. Okay, now we can move on to the next thing.
Yeah, and also I think it's important to say here that it's not just for people who are verbal.
Oh, absolutely.
So for example, yeah, with my son, when he was younger, we didn't know how much he could understand or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we still had, you know, and he wasn't able at that time to participate in the creation of the social story. But we, our social stories are basically about rules of behavior, like going to the library, because he loved going to the library.
Mm-hmm.
But they were like three sentences of the three rules stated positively,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
like what was going to happen in the library and
mm-hmm.
what was going to happen if he didn't act in those positive manners was actually leaving the library. It was to get him, because he was at a point where he was ripping books
mm.
at home.
Mm-hmm.
So he
mm-hmm.
go rip books in a library. That's
mm-hmm.
just then.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was funny because that's when we figured out that he was actually understanding what he was hearing and not just visually, because people started to forget to bring it, the paper with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the laminated card.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would get there and they would just tell him. And, you know, he got to the point where he just knew what he was supposed to do, or he just needed
a prompt.
Verbal reminder.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. So it's really helpful. And so for people out there who are afraid to try things because they think their child doesn't understand, you don't know. You can never assume that they don't understand.
No, as a matter of fact, I have a lot of children, as you're suggesting, like your son, who initially are not verbal, and eventually either they are able to access verbal skills or through augmentative communication means they are able to let us know what's going on. And they will tell me that they remember exactly what happened is when they were younger, and it was very frustrating for them because they couldn't communicate, but it didn't mean that they didn't understand. That they heard, but they felt frustrated because they didn't have an access to letting us know that they knew what was going on.
Right. Now, I have a couple more questions, and I'm sure you're going to think, well, I've already kind of answered those, but
mm-hmm.
I know that by hearing it, it might make you think of another way.
Okay, sure.
This is from Jason in Cato.
Okay.
My son now enjoys unwrapping the gifts, so I guess they had to work on that, but how do we get him now to understand that there are ones for him, and then there are others that are for other people, so that he, and try to keep him interested in the items that we got him? So
mm-hmm.
I guess it's someone who really likes the unwrapping part now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like, again, you know, to some degree what we've been talking about, the unwrapping obviously creates a lot of sensory input for this young man. And so, again, you can practice. And role play. There's lots of different things. So first off, again, to help the family understand, he's not doing this activity because he's selfish, because he's narcissistic. He's doing it because it feels good to his body. And so to some degree, we're just going to have to practice, role playing, you know, wrapping of presents and unwrapping, and this is yours, and that's okay, and this belongs to Jim, and this belongs to Jane, and, you know, and then what we have to do is sit and watch and say, okay, let's open the present. Oh, good, look what you got, and so forth. And you practice these, you know, step-by-step-by-step skills multiple times so that when the actual, you know, unwrapping of Christmas morning comes, there's a tolerance because, again, he's experienced it. You also can supplement it by a social story, again, what's going to happen and what, you know, and create a story with pictures in terms of here's family unwrapping, and you can have the other family members come and play act this so you can actually have a story that he can look at. And you can also have written down, same kind of visual map. This is how we unwrap the present, and then we wait. We go inside, and we say, oh, look, we got it. And we say, thank you for the present. And we wait for Jim's turn, and then we wait for Jane's turn. And then, you know, and then we go for the next present. So you actually break down the fact that, yeah, it does feel good to your body, but in our family, we give everybody a chance. Now, the most important thing, I don't know if you're sort of listening to sort of my tone of my voice, what I've been really focusing on is not to get tied into the you know, to the tumult that can be associated with sometimes our kids, you know, starting to melt down. The most important thing is if you get caught up in the craziness of the moment, that, as a parent, that's just going to aggravate and accent the whole problem. Really what I do is when I begin to sort of feel some agitation going on, I really slow down my actions. Because a lot of times what happens when kids melt down is because they haven't been prepped appropriately or we're moving too fast. And so I try to really slow things down. I give very definitive boundaries. Sometimes what I'll say, you know, do you need a special time away to have a breather before, again, it's, I begin to see like the water boiling, but it hasn't hit its pitch, because it's much easier to, you know, to sort of stamp out embers than it is a raging fire. And so you have to get, to some degree, you have to get good to sort of anticipate and give a chance for kids to take a break. But if you prep them with enough time, usually what ends up happening, and practice of these, that the, you know, opening of the presence can be stressful, but not to the point where they can't participate. And ultimately, it could be something that's enjoyable, because you also, we sometimes forget to really acknowledge our kids, you know, on simple gestures, which is so such a big deal for them, like, wow, you were able to sit and let Jane and Jim open up their presence today. That's really great. You know, then you acknowledge how hard it was for them to do something like that, because all kids like to be acknowledged. And for our children, what appears to be super, you know, simple gestures is enormous, because it means that they're one step closer to being a reciprocal member of their community.
Mm-hmm. And in speaking about that area, here's a question from Carrie in Michigan. My son is 9 years old and has Asperger's. His biggest deficit area is social skills. Normally we celebrate Christmas Eve at home, but this year we're going to my mom's house. So how can I prepare him for this and keep his anxiety level down? Now I know you'll talk about the mapping and so forth, but is there a way that he could role play with the social skills things that he might be doing at his mom's or his grandmother's house?
Sure, absolutely. And this is when you're going to have grandma's help. You know, and again, I don't know where grandma lives in the sense that it's in the same town so that they can sort of practice going over to the grandparents' house, or if it's out of town, so it's more difficult. But I think what it is now, and it might be helpful in terms of saying, like, you know, Mom, could you send me pictures of the different rooms, you know, so we can actually create a book and say we're going to go to this room and then we're going to go this and this and this, and really kind of role play and break it down to what's going to happen, and ask, you know, Grandma to really be kind of sensitive that we're going to go over to your house, Mom, but we want to, you know, we want to try to create an environment that's really a success. Tell me first, what is your expectation of the evening or the day, and let me tell you what we can do, you know, or not do. And it might be that, you know, oh, well, we're going to have, you know, 40 relatives come over because, you know, they haven't seen you and the kids and so forth. And you can say, well, you know what, we can probably tolerate about 10 people. And so, you know, can we, you know, and so, like, I'll give you a perfect example. Having nothing to do with special needs, over this particular Hanukkah holiday, I have you know, several very young grandchildren. And we started the party about an hour earlier for the little ones. And we had about a half an hour overlap where we had the adults come. And so they could have some kind of interaction, but they were basically getting ready to leave as the adults were coming. And so there was a few minutes of interaction, but really the children had already had their special time where they had their presence and they had their age-appropriate support. And then the adults, then their parents took them home, and then we had more of the adult evening function. And, you know, a couple people said, oh, wouldn't it have been nice for the children to stay a little bit longer? We said, well, yeah, it would have been nice, but you know what, they're little, and we have to acknowledge that they have needs that, you know, means they have to go to bed earlier. So, but I appreciate the fact that you know, have that feeling.
You know, there's a question here that's not specific about the holidays, but I'd be interested in hearing what kind of advice you could possibly give these people, if you
sure.
don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Christine from Raleigh.
Okay.
My 11-year-old son, so it's an 11-year-old son with Asperger's.
Mm-hmm.
He has a difficult time taking someone else's perspective, and yet he's extremely intelligent, so he uses logical arguments to persuade those around him to do what he wants. For example, I might need to spend the morning baking for a family get-together in the afternoon. I make it clear that he needs to finish chores before he has free time. Instead, he'll pester his brother, sneak TV time, read in his room, everything but get his chores done. By the time the family is ready to go, he hasn't finished his chores, and he's ranting that he won't get his video time because we're leaving the house. It becomes a battle, and everyone is agitated. However, his 9-year-old neurotypical brother understands that if you make mom happy by doing what you're told, you get video time and the household is peaceful. I can see why my Aspie's teachers will call him oppositional defiant, even though I don't approve of that terminology. What strategy do I use to convince this very smart, immature boy to work with me?
Okay. Thank you. I think it's a fantastic question. And I want to emphasize the fact that this is such a smart boy, okay? Because he's sort of strategically figuring out how to do things that he wants to do. And he doesn't like to do chores. It doesn't feel good to his body. It's, you know, boring or hard or, you know, whatever it is. And he'd rather do other things. But he doesn't obviously know how to organize his time appropriately to, you know, do what he needs to do. Plus, you know, then also, you know, get his videos done. And he's very good at creating kind of chaos for the family. One of the things that I would do is, I think, I'm guessing that this mom is verbally giving him tasks that he needs to do in terms of his chores. And for a lot of our kids who have auditory processing concerns, they don't necessarily get all the messages that we tell them verbally. It's almost like being on a bad cell phone conversation where they get bits and pieces of the message rather than the whole point. And so what I do is you can certainly give him the verbal message, but you have to supplement that, again, as we've been talking about all evening long, with visual maps. This is what we need to do, and this is the time frame you need to do it. And he has to do it and check it off. And then also you put down and, you know, and the consequences. And for this particular type of task, you get this kind of video time. I guess the question was he get upset because he doesn't get his video time. And so you can, and this young man, at least at this point, cannot be left to his own devices. One of the things mom's contrasting is the fact that there's a 9-year-old neurotypical brother who really gets it. The problem is, even though this young man is 11, it doesn't feel like he's 11. She actually even mentions the fact that he is immature. So again, I'm using that DIR framework. Even though he is chronologically 11, this young man feels younger. He feels more like 8 or 9 years old at best, okay, even though he's very smart. So we, with an 8 or 9-year-old, I'm going to be much more involved to sort of micromanage a little bit in terms of the task that I need my child to complete. So I may check on him much more frequently than I would on an 11-year-old. So part of it is, even though he's very intelligent, coming to terms with the fact that right now I have to help with my relationship, my R, support his, whatever the underlying individual neurological issues are, because I'm really dealing with a child who's 8 or 9, so I have to give him a little bit more support than I would even his 9-year-old brother.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting situations that families have, isn't it?
It's real life, you know?
I know.
Yeah.
I guess you're never bored with the work that you do.
I have to share with you, you know, I joke around and I say I have the best job in the world because I get to play with kids and toys all day long. But I love what I do. I mean, I really do, because my families teach me every single day, you know, by their example, by their humbleness, by their perseverance, by their advocacy, and I'm just honored to be in their company. I really am. But thank you for that compliment, because it's just I never get bored whatsoever, and I just enjoy it enormously. And you know, to be honest with you, I have we have 4 children, and I've shared with my kids the one blessing that I give all of them, no matter what direction life they take, is to just find something that you're passionate with and just love what you do every day. And you know, I've been blessed to have found that within the work that I do.
Well, and I think that people are blessed that you're there as a resource.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, here's one probably going to be the. Well, maybe not. We probably have time for 2 more. Here's a question. I don't know who it's from. How do I get through this holiday season with family and friends who don't know or haven't accepted my child's needs, and how should they be handled? So how do you go about telling the family and friends without offending them in a way if they're already not accepting the child's needs? Do you have some suggestions?
In other words, one more time. So, in other words, if a family is this is a family or friends who are just not accepting
who know or haven't accepted my child's needs.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, to some degree, you know, you can only do what you're going to do. And you have to go ahead, and as I said before, and there have been a couple of other similar questions this evening, where I believe you can alert family members ahead of time to, you know, the situation. Sometimes families or friends just don't get it for multiple reasons. I run several support groups at our center, and one of the support groups I run is for grandparents. And I've had grandparents who range from, you know, grandparents who totally get it and are always available to help their families, to grandparents who are just disbelieving. They just think that their adult children are just poor managers of time, or, you know, don't have any, you know, capacity to really know how to discipline their kids and so forth. When I really get down to trying to help them understand that this is a real situation and the children isn't because they don't know how to manage time and so forth, what they'll share with me is basically their sense of helplessness, that they really don't know how to even wrap their heads around this idea that they have a grandchild with disabilities. And they feel very sad, and they don't like feeling helpless when it comes to knowing how to support their adult child and certainly their grandchild with disabilities. So, I mean, sometimes I have to get to the root of really what the issue is that prevents them from hearing the message from their adult child. The other part where I share with the adult child is you can try as best you can. If a friend or a family member is unable to take in the message, and you've tried a variety of ways, emailed, phone call, and you still get a lot of resistance, you then have the right to protect yourself and your child. And you can say to them, if you are unable to give support, I may not be able to be with you as much as I would like. No. And you can protect yourself and your child by saying, we're going to have to limit our contact and so forth, because this is our life, and this is a situation that's not going to go away, and I would love your support, but I also understand that maybe it's going to take time for you to be comfortable with that idea. And some families never are. You know, I still have families who say that my child is 9 years old and is autistic, and to this day my mother doesn't acknowledge that.
Yeah. It is tough. It's really tough when you are in situations like that. And I always tell parents that sometimes they just have to decide what the boundaries are going to be.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You have to limit your children. Well, you and your children, your immediate family comes first.
Right.
Then you have to kind of limit the outside stressors so people can be helpful, and they can be helpful and stressors, and then some are just downright stressors. And so you just kind of have to not feel guilty about spending all the time with these people because they're related to you, if they're creating more havoc in your life, and if it's something that you can't, with information to them, with knowledge to them, if they're really not open to it, you can just offer it every once in a while, but you can't allow their stresses to become your stresses.
Exactly. Exactly right. Exactly right. And this is part of a parent kind of coming to terms with this acceptance that we were talking about, you know, in terms when you have a child with special needs, that sometimes it's not about being perfect and, you know, meeting other people's expectations. It's about taking care of yourself and your family.
Absolutely right. We're going to be ending this in a couple of minutes. I did want to let people know that on my website you can have access to an article that I wrote on the Examiner about holiday tips, and you can get that by going to my website, which is, I'm going to spell my very complicated name, chantalsicile-kira.com. And if you go to my homepage and click on the Examiner button, you will go immediately to the article. Otherwise, you can go to examiner.com and type in my name, and you will find that article if you want to sit down and read that. Otherwise, Dr. Hess, would you please like to remind everyone of your web address where they can get more information about you?
Absolutely, and I'll also add one more piece, but let me give you my web address one more time. It's www.centerfortheDevelopingMind.com. And I'm also a monthly columnist for LA Family Magazine, and in the December issue, we have a whole page of suggestions regarding how to get through the challenges associated with the holiday. And then if you can stay tuned for January, we're going to talk about New Year's resolutions and particularly how to deal with self-care issues of parents, which is to a large degree what we talked about today as well, and that's LAFamilyMagazine.com.
That's great. That's really important. The self-care, as you mentioned earlier, it's nice to know that you have a whole issue or at least an article on that topic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I would like to remind our listeners that if they'd like to give feedback, they can call 877-211-0212 and press 1. Again, that's 877-211-0212 and press 1. And I would like to tell our listeners that our next webinar is on January 11th, 2010. It's about succeeding in college with autism or Asperger's syndrome. And my guest is Ann Palmer, who has been working for 13 years with families of individuals with autism at Division Teach. And she has a son with Asperger's and has written a book about preparing for college. Thank you so much, Dr. Hess, for being my guest this evening. Thank you for all your advice.
It's been absolutely my pleasure. Let me wish you and your listeners tonight a wonderful, wonderful holiday season and the best of Happy New Year's.
Thank you very much. And yes, to all our listeners from me and also from MomsFightingAutism.com, all the best during this holiday season and I wish you all the best for a happy, healthy, and wealthy 2010.
Okay, please. Amen.
Thank you, Dr. Hess, and good night to everyone. And until next year, then, be the change that you want to see.